Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Jason Hazley.
And I'm Joel Morris.
And as usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works. Or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is the magnificent Jim Field Smith.
Hello.
Hello. That was a magnificent hello there.
Thank you.
You are a director of things.
I am.
But you come from a very solidly sort of performative and writing comedy background. And then you were the one of the gang who went off to get behind the camera.
The last of the gang to die. Yeah. The first of the gang to die. I was the first one to go, I should stop acting.
Did someone say that to you?
The others have all continued.
Because you were in Dutch Elm with Dan Skinner and Rufus Jones and Jordan.
And Steve. Which in itself was sort of a sort of happy accident in a way, because it wasn't like I was desperate to perform either, but I sort of ended up in that sketch group with them, which itself was only ever really meant to be a sort of side project, and then that kind of blossomed into this successful thing.
You were nominated for a Perrier,
nominated for the Perrier when it was still the Perrier, and I actually have a Perrier bottle in glass on my
they give you one for a nom.
They do.
Bugger all for
they give you the same one. They give you the same one whether you win or get nominated.
Really?
So, yeah.
Not really worth trying, is it?
No. No.
If you're looking for a bottle.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a fucking socialist award, isn't it?
Yes, it is very, very. It's all different now, of course. Yeah, so I was in Dutch Elm with those guys and who I'm still very close with. But sort of very quickly wasn't that I didn't enjoy performing, but it was that I realised that the bit of being in the group that I liked was sort of everything apart from performing or everything around it. So
well, the organisation
of it and the writing of it, and we were sort of self-directed to a certain extent, but figuring out what the show was going to be. And yeah, me and Rufus did a lot of the kind of overall writing and kind of conceptually, and then the guys kind of came in and finessed it and worked on the character stuff. But that was the bit of Dutch Elm that I used to really enjoy, and at the same time I was starting to direct bits and pieces outside of that, and I sort of had always done a lot of stuff like sound engineering and graphic design and all these things just suddenly kind of coalesced into, oh, I should just not be in front of the camera or on the stage. I should be doing everything else. But having that knowledge of being a performer and understanding what being in a group is like, and having the kind of what the neuroses are of performing and so on, has been really helpful, I think.
I think that's useful for anyone, is you should cross disciplines. I mean, we always used to say that I didn't start really learning. I'd written a lot, but I don't think I really started learning to write until we nagged our way onto a set.
Because as a writer, you're never on a set. And we nagged her. I said, could we be extras in things? Because I'd never seen a shot be set up. I've been in the booth for sort of live recordings and things, but I'd not been on a set watching the catering trucks and things come in. And just to see what people were going through and to go, oh, that's why I shouldn't ask the impossible. I didn't even realise I was asking the impossible.
Sure.
But just to, that empathy of saying at some point someone's going to have to make this, someone's going to have to do it, someone's going to have to perform this. It's really useful to step out of being a writer or a backstage person and say, okay, what are they going through up there? Just watch closely.
Yeah, and part of the kind of British model of TV making and filmmaking has traditionally been that the writer isn't really involved in production.
Yeah.
You know, we have this very linear system in the UK where a writer writes a script and then that gets greenlit and then some people go off and shoot it, and the writer probably isn't really involved in that process at all. It's changing a little bit now because of the influence of the American system. But I always say, like, I never personally have an issue with writers being on set at all.
You're a fucking spare wheel when you turn up, but as long as you don't mind being completely useless.
And what you learn is, oh, that thing that I wrote, that is actually really hard to do, and I can see that they're really struggling with this or whatever, or actually, oh, that's nowhere near as hard as I thought it was, and I could have written something much more ambitious or whatever. So,
and also watching what actors do with things. And I remember writing, there was a scene, I think, in Touch of Cloth, which I remember thinking on the page, like, God, this is a, and that was a gag script. And it was a bit where there were no gags for about two pages. It was just a bit of drama.
Mm.
And I remember thinking, fuck, we should give that another polish, and turned up and then watched two brilliant actors do it. And it was one of the funniest scenes. It was just a sexy flirting scene. They brought all their chops to it.
Mm.
They were fucking amazing. And he went, oh, I need to leave some spaces. It wasn't just, oh, the things I've written are impossible. It was also, when I haven't written something, someone will fill that gap if I leave a gap. Whether it's production design or a cameraman, there's little spaces for people to add their flourishes.
Mm.
And I don't think I'd ever have learned that. I'd always have just looked at the page and gone, not enough jokes, without realising that sometimes you need to
leave
space for other people to do stuff.
I think that's also because a lot of British comedy writers come up through that kind of radio writing route.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, radio writing is by its very nature more, for comedy, is more gag intensive. And
it's done in front of an audience usually.
And everything has to be explained and said, or done with sound. Obviously, the visual medium opens a lot of that up. And as you say, there are all these different crafts that suddenly become involved that can add stuff that you hadn't even perceived might be in there.
And I suppose you're coming from a background there of, say, graphic design and things. You're realising there are other places you can put the comedy in.
Exactly.
Which you wouldn't be in control of, I suppose, if you were just a performer or just a writer.
No. And that's also, you know, there's an element of control freakery going on here. I think
what, a director?
That's the elephant in the room. there's definitely an element of that too. I just, you know, there's also just, I'm essentially a massive nerd, so... I get to be a nerd about everything, and it's all of the stuff that I love doing.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's great.
It's amazing.
Like, when you get to just surf your nerdism, it's just such fun, isn't it?
When your nerdism becomes necessary rather than a burden.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, and particularly in post-production. I'm in post-production on something right now, and that is like nirvana, because it's, you've done all the really horrific bits of getting through production, even on the most glorious shoot. It's really, really, really hard. And you know, pre-production and trying to get scripts into shape and all that, and now you've just got all these raw materials. Now you're essentially, I can't remember whose quote this is, but you're essentially just looking at all of your mistakes. But the great thing is, you don't have to put those mistakes in the show.
Now is your chance to rescue them.
Yeah, exactly, or turn them into happy accidents or whatever it is. So,
and also, who was it who said that the edit is the third part of the writing process, basically?
Yeah,
everything gets written three times.
Yeah, I always think about that a lot. I mean, I think that you have to, when you come to edit, you have to actually remove yourself from the process of having filmed it. And there's always a point when you've wrapped and you start editing. There's a period of a few weeks for me where it takes me a moment to separate myself from those dailies, because I can still look at them and go, oh, I remember what was happening on that day, or oh, I really like that shot, you know, or I really like that moment. You have to completely separate yourself from that.
You have to become a viewer.
Yeah, and go, right, let's look at this raw stuff and let's see what we can build from this raw stuff. And, you know, different editors work differently, but Dave Webb, who's an editor I work with a lot, he does look at the script, but equally he's just looking at the dailies and just building a scene from what he's seeing, which in my head is the best way of doing it. I think if you're slavishly going back to the script and saying, oh, yes, but this is what they were trying to do and let me try and make that
work. But you didn't get that.
Yeah, exactly, because everything changes, as you said, the second stage of rewriting is the shoot, and the third stage is the edit. And there is so much latitude for what you can do, and that's dangerous in itself. But yeah, there is so much latitude for change in that third stage.
I think it's one of the reasons why there's always this sort of strange, certainly in the press, a power grab for creativity from each, from a person who was there involved in the creative process at each stage. So the writer will go, this is all my vision, and I can't believe what they did to it. And then the actors will go, we improvised it all on set. It was amazing, the latitude we had. Mm. And the editor will secretly sulk and go, that was shit before I got hold of it.
Mm.
Because everyone's got a claim on having written this thing. But actually, the three processes together get there. I was listening to Taika Waititi talking about making Thor, thinking a huge blockbuster. And the way he describes it, you think they just made it up on the set.
Mm.
And he's very dismissive of, in a nice way, of the original script, because they went wildly off it. But part of me went, yeah, a guy worked out how all those events would line up in a, it's a superhero epic. It's hard to write.
Yeah.
But the sort of dismissiveness of that first part of the process is as ludicrous as saying the actors made it all up on set.
Yeah.
Whatever it is you're doing, he will obviously have in his head what a huge job it was doing the edit.
Sure.
So for him, that's the freshest form of the writing. So you can dismiss the first part. But each part, each pass on this thing is a hugely difficult nine-dimensional jigsaw.
Yeah.
And then you put them together, hopefully.
And there's a fourth part as well, which is people's own interpretations of what you've made. You know, you may think you've made something that's absolutely clear, or you may think you've made something that's, you know, where everything's so subtle, and yet, you know, you've got this fourth bit that you can never fully predict, which is how is the audience gonna take it, and what are they gonna decide this thing is? They're gonna decide what genre it is. They're gonna decide what whether it's funny. They're gonna decide all these things about it that you actually have only a limited amount of control over, even if you're at the absolute top of your game.
I didn't realise that when you do a film, when you basically you hand over the responsibility to build the trailer for the film is done by the studio, and they don't take the film, they take everything, they take every shot, so they've got everything that they can use daily.
They've usually cut a trailer before you've cut the film.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, often you can see a cut from a, certainly on a studio movie, you'll see a cut of a trailer way before you've cut the movie, which is why trailers often have shots in them that aren't in the film.
Yeah.
There's all that sort of conspiracist debate as well, especially amongst the nerd community. Why is the Hulk running forwards in Avengers, Infinity War? Because the studio made that.
Yeah.
Are you good at finishing something, though? Or do you then watch a series or a film that you've done, go out and go, I might have another look at that?
Well, I definitely look at stuff that I've done in the past and think, oh, I can see what I was doing then. I can see how I've grown since I made that. And I would never do that now, even though at the time I thought that was great. But also I'm able to let it go and say, but that's just growth. That's just creative growth. It's okay to have made something 10 years ago.
That's never occurred to me. Is that why it's hard to let something go? Because usually you're doing it for quite a long time.
Mm.
By the time you finish the process, you've probably learned more than the beginning.
Yeah, that is definitely true.
I want November me to have a pass at what June me did.
That's definitely true. And particularly on a TV series with multiple episodes. So, you know, what's happening now in the industry more and more, which is great, is that directors tend to direct whole runs of things. You know, the old TV model was that you'd have different directors. Everything I've done, I've directed all of it, essentially, because I come from that film background rather than the trad TV background. And what happens is you tend to have to lock episodes sequentially. And so what happens is you will lock. So at the moment, I'm editing a show and I'm about to lock the first episode.
Yeah.
Now, I won't lock episode 8 until February. And we're now in whatever month we're in now, December.
December.
Thank you for reminding me.
It's a big ticking clock on the wall.
And so what happens is you get to February and you have to be really careful that you're not thinking and sometimes it's just a stylistic thing that by the time you get to episode 8 you've kind of morphed into a slightly different kind of thing that you're like, and then you have to try and retroactively make that work for the first episode. So and I think you have to be honest and relate back to what you've done already, and you have to resist that urge slightly and just go, no, I'm not doing that because that's not what I've been making.
Right.
Yeah, I can't get ahead of myself. And maybe that's for the next time. You know, maybe that's for the next. And you have to put it in a drawer for the next project or whatever. You have to be true to the thing that you set out to make, I think. And I think also that the way that technology has affected creativity has meant that things are being made essentially with less thought or with too many options. And so traditionally, you know, certainly when I started out as a runner working in television, if a director was sitting in an edit, for example, and decided he wanted a piece of music, you would be sent out as a runner to HMV to buy that in my case, on CD. You'd then take the CD to Stanley's on Wardour Street. That would be then digitized onto U-matic or Beta. Then you'd take that tape back to the edit. It would be up. It would be digitized back into the Avid. And then, and only then, would they be able to go, is this the right track? Oh, no, it's not. Start again.
Right.
Whereas now, wow, we can call up any piece of music, any sound effect, any, you know, to a certain extent, any visual effect within seconds. And so you have to avoid the temptation of the sort of sweetie jar of there's all this stuff over here. Because when I started out making short films, one of the best bits of advice I got from a producer friend was shoot them on film. And it's more of a hassle. And it'll cost you more, and you'll be have people saying to you, oh, I'll shoot digitally. But she said, shoot on film, and I'll help you out, and we'll figure out a way to make it work. And I shot both of my first two short films on 35mm. And the difference that makes in that you're going, I've bought these rolls of film on my credit card.
Yeah.
I have 10 rolls, and I have to get all of these shots across 2 days, and I've got these actors who are scary to me at this point because I'm quite early in my career, like yeah. Imelda Staunton and James Cosmo and all these people who are, you know, very accomplished people, and I'm just a guy. And what it made me do was make choices prior to shooting and make choices while I was shooting that I was then stuck with. And that's really, really... I think that's really, really important.
Too many options is not helpful.
It's paralysis. You can't make them all at once. I'm saying this with music mixing. I always used to insist when we were making music and things on saying, look, the guitar's going through this amplifier, through these pedals, and that's going on the track. So that when we later on have to mix it, you don't have to decide which amplifier and which pedals it's going through, because you'll be making 100 other decisions at that point. How loud it is.
That's what my producer, when I was in a band, used to say. He resisted it. We used to say, print this effect to tape. We want on tape. We don't want to come back and just rebuild this effect. You know, just do it. Well, no, we should keep the clean one just for options. No, just print it. Because I'd heard from a friend of mine who was an engineer, a very seasoned engineer and producer, that he'd been called in to work on someone very famous's album, a female solo artist. And he was asked, they said, look, we've got a Pro Tools rig here. Can you comp the best vocals for these two songs? And he said, yeah, no problem. For those of you who don't know what this means, comping is when you've got two or three vocal takes and you choose the best bits of each to build one vocal take, which has got all the best bits of it. He sat down at the Pro Tools rig and he was faced with 96 vocal takes of each song. 96. Oh. And he was sitting there for a fortnight picking individual syllables of words and building a vocal comp. And eventually he just walked off the project saying, this is the least creative thing I've ever done.
You need to make decisions as you go, because any creative process is a process of making decisions, making hundreds of decisions. The final thing you watch when you enjoy it or don't enjoy it, you're enjoying it or not enjoying it based on the taste of the tastemakers who've made it. And the point is, there's a strange habit, especially now, as you're saying, with modern technology, to hold off having any taste decisions until the very last minute, at which point you have to make 1 million decisions at once. And you're far better off making them as you go along because your taste's operating 24/7.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's one of the things that's contributing to the issue with cinema at the moment is that the lean towards the kind of Marvel Cinematic Universe, sort of superhero-driven studio tentpole franchise movies is partly just to do with like that's the only thing they can get young people to come and see, which then becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, obviously. But the other issue is that you've got these movies that are being driven more and more by the visual effects requirements. And so what happens is when you make these movies, you're often practically shooting very little stuff. You've got actors in essentially entirely green screen environments reacting to things that they're not quite sure what they're going to look like in the final cut. You're shooting everything in coverage. You're shooting 1,000 options. And then the film essentially is built later on. The stuff that you shot is just one element of putting that film together, which is, if you think about it, is insane.
You don't really know the story.
No.
You're not telling a story.
No, you'll have a script and you'll shoot it, but essentially you're just shooting actors as elements, you know, and then you're piecing together a movie from that, and you can change everything about it. And what that's done is it's kind of killed, I think, kind of what I would describe as kind of mid-level cinema or mid-level filmmaking. You know, I was very lucky that I got a break early on to make to me at the time, it was monstrously huge, but a $25 million movie, which is essentially a mid-sized movie.
Was this Butter?
No, that was She's Out of My League.
Yeah. Right.
You know, to me as a 20-something, it was obviously a huge undertaking. But that, by Hollywood standards, is essentially a small to mid-sized movie. Those size of movie just aren't really getting made anymore, certainly not in the volume that they were. And they tended to be comedies. I mean, that is the bracket that most comedies sit in. And like I said, it is a self-fulfilling prophecy slightly. The lesser than the mate you make, the less people want to go and see them. Yeah. But those kind of movies are made in a very traditional way. You shoot, you have a script, you get the best bunch of people together that you can possibly find, and you go and shoot it, and you try and make it as funny as possible and as interesting as possible. Yes, you can edit it and you can change it to a certain degree, but essentially you're still making and trying to release the same thing that you set out to make. That is not happening that often anymore. And I think that's sad, actually, because I think, you know, that was a really rich, particularly in the 80s and 90s, you know, with John Hughes and the movie we're going to talk about
John
in a minute.
Landis,
That was a very, very rich scene. And they were very, very successful movies, too, because they were made at a moderate price point and they went on to gross large amounts of money.
Mm. I think we should naturally move from that onto what we're talking about, because this is a perfect example of a film that I think changed what people thought was possible.
Mm.
In that this is both a goofy Saturday Night Live comedy of that budget.
And also, one of Tarkovsky's finest movies.
And also,
hang on a second, I think I might have
wrong. And a cartoon. No, but also both that and also a huge tentpole special effects blockbuster brought out to sort of smash the Star Wars coffers open in a summer. Mm. And it managed to somehow and almost uniquely be both and still be beloved today. So what have you brought in?
Ghostbusters.
Ooh. Exactly what's going to happen on the fucking
edit. Busting makes me feel good.
No, I'm just going to fade up I Need a New Drug by Huey Lewis. I
Awesome boogie woogie. There's a lot of boogie woogie in the score.
It's very boogie woogie heavy, isn't it?
Do you know what? It's a weird score, isn't
and
it?
And he was really unhappy. Is it Bernstein?
Emma Bernstein was
really unhappy with the amount of commercial music that ended up in the movie.
Right.
I think it was just a product of the time, partly, that was the expectation of those films. But also, I have to say, like, I personally, watching it, don't feel like those tracks stand out in a bad way. Like they always seem to land in about the right spot.
They're quite urban, New Yorky, Saturday Night Live-y. They've got that.
They're very of the time.
And also just the fact it opens with some boogie woogie piano and it's the Blues Brothers guys.
Yeah.
Come on, this is perfect for what you're being sold as an audience. You want a bit of stride piano.
Yeah, it's ground. It makes it grounded, I suppose. You know, and I think that's something the film generally does really, really well.
Well, that was his pitch, Aykroyd's pitch, which I hadn't. This is a comedy film with one joke in the middle, and the one joke, which is always good with a comedy film. Sometimes you just want one joke, and the central joke is they're exterminators.
Mm.
It's a supernatural film written to be like a ghost special effects movie. And he said he had an elevator pitch and it was ghost janitors in New York.
Mm.
And he goes, brilliant. So it gives you a blue collar, boogie woogie piano.
But I think if you go backwards from that, I think originally Aykroyd's pitch was that it was going to be this big special effects extravaganza, this kind of multi, you know, $200 million thing.
It was set in the future or something.
Yeah, it was set in alternate worlds, and it was about this team kind of traveling between different worlds. And it was Ivan Reitman who said, we're not going to get the financing to do it. Mm. So how can we do it? But also just comedically, I think this would be better off set in a grounded, real place. And let's do it in New York.
I love this town!
Well, that opens up a gag that has been successful ever since, which is it is one you did for the wrong man's. It is a wrong man's.
Yeah.
Who are you going to call? Is the question. And the answer is not those guys.
Yeah.
When these guys turn up, the answer is, oh, them?
Yeah.
Because they do look like pest exterminators.
Yeah. I hope we could take care of this quietly tonight.
Yes, sir. Don't worry. We handle this kind of thing all the time.
And the central joke is blue collar, but with this, I think you get a lot of credit goes to Aykroyd for the script, which was very, very supernaturally informed. But then he passed it to Harold Ramis, who'd come from Second City and was very, very clever. And there's lots of intellectual or pseudo-intellectual, almost Monty Python-y level long words and bobbins put on top of it that says this is very highfalutin. And then you throw into that incredible bathos of the blue collarness of everything.
Yes.
And Bill Murray in the middle as the man who's taking none of it on face value.
And this voice said, Zool. And then I slammed the refrigerator door and I left. That was 2 days ago, and I haven't been back to my apartment.
Generally, you don't see that kind of behavior in a major appliance. What do you think it was?
Well, if I knew what it was, I wouldn't be here.
You know what it could be? Past life experience intruding on present time.
Could be erased memories stored in the collective unconscious. I wouldn't rule out clairvoyance or telepathic contact either.
I'm sorry. I don't believe in any of those things.
Well, that's all right. I don't either.
Yeah, and Bill Murray's doing the thing that he does so well, but I have to say, rewatching it, I had forgotten quite how sort of despicable he is in the first sort of acts. I mean,
yeah, that was admirable back then. That was the guy we all wanted to be.
Yeah, but there's
sleazy Harvey Weinstein guy.
Yeah, the stuff that he's up to at the university with the electroshock therapy and.
Hey, I'm getting a little tired of this.
You volunteered, didn't you? We're paying you, aren't we?
Yeah, but I didn't know you were going to be giving me electric shocks.
Yeah, and the girl that the stock 1980s girl that's called Jennifer.
Yeah,
that's in every 1980s movie.
They got her out of a cupboard, didn't they? Yeah. Marked Jennifer.
Yeah, they did.
You may as well get used to that. It's the kind of resentment that your ability is going to provoke in some people.
Do you think I have it, Dr. Venkman?
You're no fluke, Jennifer.
Along with the sort of the dean in a three-piece suit with a slightly British accent, who's also in every in every 80s movie. But yes, he's astonishingly unlikable, actually. And what's really interesting, the character choice they made, I don't know whether it was Bill Murray or whether it was in the script, but even though he's a paranormal investigator and he believes in paranormal stuff, when we meet him at the beginning of the film, we show him in a job that essentially where he's a doctor of this stuff. He's a parapsychologist. When you meet Sigourney Weaver, when they meet Dana later in the film, he is dubious of all of her claims and yet pretends to believe them so that he can get into bed with her. And you're like, but no, hang on, you do believe in this
There is a complete lack of clarity. Like, this time I'm watching it, I went, I don't know. I know what I'm meant to do. The cool guy in this movie is going to be Han Solo.
Yeah.
He's going to be the guy who swaggers in and goes, hey, all this stuff's bullshit.
Ectoplasmic residue.
Venkman, get a sample of this.
When somebody blows their nose and you want to keep it?
I'd like to analyze it.
Even though that guy doesn't exist in the character breakdown for this film because they are all paranormal investigators, it's like a sit-vac thing. There is a situation vacant for a debunking, cynical guy.
Mm.
And because it's Bill Murray, it's casting, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You go, well, he doesn't believe any of this bullshit.
Yeah.
And at the beginning, he's tricking the girl. He's not
using the parapsychology
in order to get a girl into bed. So that falls... It kind of works, but it's a real fudge.
But he's also not flummoxed when he does experience real spooky stuff. So, for example... You know, and it's just something Bill Murray does really well anyway. But for example, when they see Slimer for the first time, he's disgusted by being slimed by him, but he's not actually
freaked out
by it. And they're then off running around the hotel trying to catch him in the trap, and they're not really scared by it at all. Which
he ain't afraid of no ghost.
They ain't afraid of no ghost.
Batman, what happened? Are you okay?
He slimed me.
That's great! Actual physical contact!
It is really interesting how fast and loose it plays with the beliefs of those characters, given that that is the title of the film.
Well, it's interesting because I think it was written originally, Dan Aykroyd had like a family history of spiritualism or something like that, and basically he wanted to make it really hardcore about the Fox sisters and Arthur Conan Doyle. He wanted to put all that stuff in it. And almost none of that's gone in except for in a lovely way. You're talking about sort of drafts and things like that. That you can feel that someone's done this hard work.
Yes.
And it's got a nice feeling of being about the paranormal. And that lovely, there's a bit of exposition they do right near the end where they're in jail and they say about the building being Spook Central and that it's been built by this cultist. And you go, that I bet you is 90% of Aykroyd's first script being delivered as a 2 minute exchange. They have to go, so that's what's been going on.
The architect's name was Ivo Shandor. I found it in Tobin's spirit guide. He was also a doctor, performed a lot of unnecessary surgery. And then in 1920, he started a secret society.
Let me guess. Gozer worshippers.
But you don't care what's been going on because Bill Murray's been swaggering about being cool.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting how far buried into the film you get is into, the actual story.
Yes, you get into the mythology of Goza and all that. Really, it doesn't matter. Really late. And
it's
actually
a masterclass in saying don't fuss that because people will just take it on trust. And but also they'll want to know at some point. But
also you get into the ghost busting really late in the film. The hotel sequence with Slimer is about a third of the way into the movie.
Yeah, do you
which
know what?
For a movie called Ghostbusters,
I made a note of this.
Have we got
because,
timing?
The first times you see them in their uniforms with the equipment, in other words, the version of them that you would buy as a toy, is 32 minutes into a 107-minute film.
Theme song, 40 minutes in.
Amazing.
But 50,
that's a hell of a cold open.
But 15 minutes in, which was quite quick, all the setup's in place.
Yeah, well, that's
what
they do.
There's a business here.
Yeah.
And it's just them on the steps of the library going, hey, this could be a business. And I quite like the fact that it was a quick move in. You know what's going to happen. And they sort of hold, I mean, I suppose the ectomobile and the costumes is where you put the monster or the shark. It's about 45 minutes into Alien, the Alien chest bursts. You want your big marquee moment to be not too near the beginning, otherwise people just get tired.
Yeah, I agree. And they do a lot of work in the first 20 minutes, I would say. You know, Sigourney Weaver's not introduced until about 20 minutes into the film.
She feels about right. I wondered about that and thought, would it have been better to see her being haunted at the beginning rather than the librarian? I went, no, I like the idea of
getting
a new character to
come in. It's great because you've got to know, particularly for her story, you've got to know Bill Murray pretty well, but you've got to know Venkman pretty well by that point. And so when you see her, you're like, oh, I'm going to enjoy seeing these two. Because basically there's this sort of chalk and cheese rom-com in the centre of the movie.
It's a really... my big takeaway from this, which I hadn't noticed before, because the thing about Ghostbusters, why everyone loves dressing up as Ghostbusters and playing the toys, why it was a hit, is it's a gang. It's a gang of mates doing a fun thing, and they've got a fun house. It's a tree house. We've got a pole. Mm-hmm. They're literally the banana splits. They're the monkeys. They're a gang of mates who are going to get together and do something. They're the Beatles in Help.
This place is great. When can we move in? You've got to try this pole. I'm going to get my stuff.
But it's not a gang movie at all, because there are three characters I barely get to know. And the one character I follow through who's got an arc I care for is Bill Murray.
Yeah.
And it's Bill Murray and his mates. And I remember thinking when I first saw it, he's the star. He's the guy you want to be, and he's the cool one. But I hadn't watched it and thought, there's a couple of scenes with like Dan Aykroyd and Ernie Hudson in a car. They say a couple of things to each other, but you don't get to know the other
particularly is you don't get to know the other guys at all. Quite a lot, yeah.
And it probably helps it feel tight and stops it being this rambling Saturday Night Live, all my mates have got a scene each thing.
Yeah.
In that it focuses on Bill Murray's story, and that's actually very enjoyable.
Yeah, and what they did, you know, as you were saying about, you know, Aykroyd's original draft being very, very sort of interested in the kind of spirituality and the mythology, what they did, and I think what Ivan Reitman did, and I think what the, you know, the production designer did, is they created these quite simple, childlike handholds in the film. Like, their car is basically an ambulance crossed with a hearse. They're based in a fire station. They use things like Twinkies and marshmallow men. So you can have Ramis talking about Goza and the electromagnetic spectrum and all this stuff, but you don't, doesn't matter, because as a kid, which is, you know, one of the biggest audiences for the film would be that kind of demographic. You've got handholds that you go, well, I understand what that is.
It has got kids' movie beats in it. I mean, it's got the great thing. They've got a car that's a car you want to drive as a kid. And it is related to the Bluesmobile, as in there's an emergency vehicle that Dan Aykroyd has stolen and drives.
Yes.
He likes doing that.
Yeah.
It's got flashing lights. It goes woo-woo.
There's a whole bit where he talks about the mechanics of the car, which just shouldn't be in the film at all.
It's because he wants the car. Yeah. They've got the treehouse. There's the gang thing.
Hey, we should stay here tonight. Sleep here, you know, to try it out.
They've got toys. They've got the packs. They've got things you want to buy. And it's a real understanding of there being a kid audience. There's a double bathos in it, in that it's a horror movie that's come after the wake of sort of Carrie and The Exorcist. It borrows The Exorcist for the floating scene and things like that. But it's very much aimed at a kid audience. They won't get lost. And my favourite kid audience bit in it is if you say, who's the baddie in Ghostbusters? When I was a kid and I watched it. It's not Goza. It's the guy from City Hall.
Yeah.
It's Dickless.
Yeah.
And Dickless is a character from a Roald Dahl story. He comes down. He does something unfair. He says to the guys, you can't play in your playhouse no more.
I'm warning you, turning off these machines would be extremely hazardous.
I'll tell you what's hazardous. You're facing federal prosecution for at least a half a dozen environmental violations. Now, either you shut off these beams or we shut them off for you.
That's the same of the dean at the beginning who says the funding is going to be taken away.
This university will no longer continue any funding of any kind for your group's activities.
But the kids love us.
And, the guy from the EPA, though their roles are essentially the dad saying, you know, stop having so much fun in the treehouse, basically.
But we found that when we were called in to do some fixing on the first Paddington movie, was the change we had to make was there was a really good baddie, like someone who would kill the bear, and it didn't work at all for kids, so we upped Hugh Bonneville and said, if Dad tells him off, if Dad sends him into the street, every kid knows what that means.
Yeah, sure.
And it's really important to have unfairness in things, because kids don't understand death as much as they understand someone being mean to them or unfair. Yeah. And that's Matilda. That's the whole... Roald Dahl lived for it being... That's not fair. Kids really feel... It burns a kid. And I remember that scene where he turns off the ghost containment thing being absolutely electric in the cinema.
Yes, yeah.
Because it's so... He's so... Oh, what a rotter. Yeah. I mean, it's Herbie Goes Bananas levels of Disney rotter.
And I think even the kind of the big bad stuff in the film, that the sort of the Zool and the sort of the other dimensions and so on, is essentially represented by that neighbor's dog that barks through the fence at you, you know. And I think it's a very simple, sort of tangible representation of the bad in the film. Because I think you know, it's brilliant when Dana opens her fridge and sort of sees through to another dimension.
Yeah.
And it's funny, but as a kid, that's just weird. It doesn't really feel like anything with any threat associated.
Generally,
with it.
That's not something you see in a major appliance.
Yeah, you just exactly. One of the best lines in the film. In a film stuffed with very good lines, that is one of the best.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
It's really nice just to watch it again. But I mean, I've obviously seen it lots. I assume you saw it at the time when it came out. And
My first time.
Wow.
This is one of these things. I don't know why I've never seen Ghostbusters. It's weird. But also, I'm, you know, like, I'd never seen Frasier before we looked at it for this podcast. And I still haven't seen Seinfeld.
Mm. Well, interestingly, Ghostbusters, sort of conversely to your experience of it, Ghostbusters was the first film that I was aware of existing. So as an 8-year-old,
wow,
it's the first film now that I can remember knowing that there was a film that was going to come out, and it was called Ghostbusters, and I remember the artwork, and I remember people talking about it.
Yeah. It was really, really well marketed. I remember the excitement, knowing this was coming out, knowing nothing about it. I think I'd heard the song, mm-hmm. and I'd seen the logo.
Which is amazing, because obviously pre-internet, pre-social media, they just had a very, very strong logo.
That logo is amazing. And it was designed by the associate producer, Michael Gross. Michael Gross designed it. And they designed the logo because they wanted a teaser poster that didn't have the word Ghostbusters on it.
Right.
Because the Ghostbusters had been a 1970s TV show and they didn't have the rights. Mm. And they were sorting that out. And he designed it. And he was the art director of National Lampoon.
Mm.
He obviously, they knew him from that sort of that scene. But he had designed the, if you don't buy this magazine, the dog gets it cover of National Lampoon. It's a brilliant graphic designer.
Yeah.
And he was the guy who made all the graphics in National Lampoon look like the real thing.
Yeah.
So it looks like a real company logo. It's an amazing piece of branding.
It's perfect. And I literally, we lived in Shooters Hill at the time in Southeast London, and I just literally can viscerally remember walking up Shooters Hill to school and seeing the Ghostbusters artwork on sort of pasted on a telephone junction box.
Mm.
I can literally picture that image in my head. And I also remember the TV spots at the time, because, you know, back then that's how you released a movie. It was a print campaign and TV spots.
Yeah.
And the TV spots were the TV spots that the Ghostbusters themselves make in the film.
Wow.
So it's just very meta. Right. It's very, very meta. You know, the one that you see in the film where
they're slightly awkward.
They're sort of stepping forward and looking for their marks and saying, call us today.
Are you troubled by strange noises in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread in your basement or attic?
You or any of your family ever seen a spook, specter, or ghost?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your phone and call the professionals. Go Ghostbusters.
They actually used those in a kind of very meta way as the spot, so it felt as a kid that you were being recruited to join Ghostbusters. And I remember that feeling. Of course, I didn't see it in the cinema. It was like 3 years later I saw it on VHS.
but it had a feeling, a reputation. It had a thing. It always reminds me of, there's a great story about when George Lucas was trying to market Star Wars, trying to raise money for it. And it was called something ludicrous at the time, The Adventures of the Wills of Luke Dark Killer or whatever.
Yeah.
And he had loads of alternate titles, and he went to some marketing guys, and the marketing guys came back with a report and they said, call it Star Wars. There are 1 million people in America who will go and see anything called Star Wars regardless of quality.
Mm.
And it meant he raised the money for it, because he knew that basically there was an audience out there ready for this. And I think,
and they still exist, those people.
Totally in common with all the other great blockbuster movies that we grew up with, that golden age of blockbuster fun Hollywood we all remember from the late 70s, early 80s, and into the 80s. What it's got is that when someone tells you the title or the logo, you know what the film is already. There's nothing to consider. Ghostbusters, you know what's going to be. Star Wars, you know what's going to be. Raiders of the Lost Ark and that poster, and you see the hat, and you go, because they're all based on existing properties.
Mm.
This is Dan Aykroyd trying to remake Bob Hope, Goofy, The Ghostbreakers, 1940s ghost caper comedies, and Indiana Jones' Republic serials, and Star Wars' Flash Gordon.
Mm.
They're the most astonishing properties in that they are new properties that have the quality of a sequel or a franchise before they even started. I think Ghostbusters is the best one. That poster comes up and you go, I don't need to know anything about this. I know what this is going to be, because it's a cartoon character, so it's goofy, and it's got ghosts in it.
Mm.
And you probably stumbled upon something like Abbott and Costello Meet the Wolfman that's got that comedy horror mashup before. It's got a ready-made audience.
The irony of that being that they've struggled to make it into a successful franchise. I mean, the sequel was not good. The best thing about the Ghostbusters 2 was the poster, was the ghost with two fingers up.
Again, Michael Gross probably doing his job. The graphic, I think, but that's it. I think what's great about this is it is a teaser. It's a teaser that says, do you want to go and see this? And the answer is, of course I do. I'm nine.
Mm.
And you've given me an ambulance and some guys with toys on their backs. And everything about it says, you want to be part of this. And you can go to the playground and play it afterwards. Mm. There's a real value to all those things, whether it's the DeLorean in Back to the Future or the lightsabers. All these things have got toys and play value in them, accidentally almost, but as part of
It's not cynically. I think it was...
There's a joy in saying that the filmmakers are playing as well, because they are remembering their childhoods. Because this is Dan Aykroyd said, I wanted to make a Bob Hope Ghostbuster movie. You went, well, great. Well, you're going to have joy. You'll have the same attitude to this as someone who's given a great franchise now.
Mm. For a kid's movie, there's a lot of smoking in it. They're all smoking all the time. It's mad.
It's definitely a grown-up movie. It had swearing in it. I knew it was a frat boy-y...
Well, there's a scene where Dan Aykroyd receives oral sex from a phantasm.
That is astonishingly weird, because it's a fantasy. It's a dream.
Yeah.
And you know,
it was shot originally as a. There was a whole sequence that they justified it by turning it into a dream.
When you say they justified it, they nearly justified it.
They justified it to themselves by saying that
we've
it was
all
a
done
dream.
That.
But it's actually it was a scripted sequence, and there's a 10-minute sequence at a military base where it happens, and which ended up being cut.
But these are the guys who just made Stripes. As in, it's the team who make these sort of goofy, very like college.
Yeah, I mean, there's two or three moments like that, I would say, in the film, which watching it now really, I have to say, made my skin crawl a little bit. But by the standards of a lot of other films of the era, I think it doesn't often veer into that territory. And it's, by and large, it's not a film that's patronising to kids, and it's not a film that's childish to adults, which is a really, really hard trick to pull off.
I ain't afraid of no ghosts. Jeopardy's really good. The scares are good. They're proper scary. The special effects are fucking brilliant.
Yeah, but also they cast Sigourney Weaver, who had just, well, not just, but like had was known at the time from Alien, you know, and which is a brilliant casting trick, because you, the moment you see her, you're like, oh God, what's going to happen?
Yeah, yeah, you're slightly nervous.
It's that girl from Alien. Plus, she's so classy and so grown up in the film, and you can literally feel the men in the film bumping into stuff around her.
She's not
so...
Jennifer, is she? She hasn't come out of the cupboard.
No, she hasn't. And I think that, to me, is one of the... She's the absolute rock centre of the film, in the way that, you know, we were just discussing how Bill Murray kind of rises up above the rest of the gang slightly. Yeah. I think Sigourney Weaver is the heart and soul of that film.
She's giving a stage performance. Yeah, because she's got a theatre background, hasn't she?
Yeah.
And she said, I think she wanted to do it because she'd done Alien and she wanted to do comedy. She'd done loads of comedies on stage. And what you get from this, she doesn't have a shitload of lines or even that huge a character, but it's just about the way she moves. She's a physical clown.
And she just
really
has
this
half smile on her face the whole time, which is amazing. Like, she's just, every time Bill Murray's buzzing around her saying, oh, don't worry about this, it's technical, she's just got this kind of half smile across her lips, which is really kind of beguiling and lets you know that she thinks these people are idiots too.
Yeah.
She is amazing. I was thinking,
even though she's genuinely scared.
What is that thing you're doing?
It's technical. It's one of our little toys.
Watching this, thinking she is an asset to a comedy because she is so brilliant in Galaxy Quest, is her other great comedy performance, I think. And she's a Working Girl, she's brilliant in that as well. Whenever she does a comedy, she's really brilliant because she does it completely straight and brings all this enormous dignity to it. Mm. She's very funny.
Bill Murray, I was looking at him in this film, and you might get this, Jim, because you understand actors better than either of us do, I think. But Bill Murray is really enjoying and using the space that he's in whenever he is on camera.
Yeah.
There's a lovely moment where he vaults over the desk, you know, and things like that. And
pirouetting in the square with the guy who's doing roller skating.
Yes, the Sound of Music moment.
But I was thinking about him in Groundhog Day, in that beautiful scene in Groundhog Day where he has ordered the entire cake menu and is sitting in the diner just stuffing his face with cake and going, he's really using every bit of that shot that he's
in. Well, also, that is Bill Murray, but it's Reitman, really, because Ivan Reitman shoots, and I hadn't realised until I rewatched this film recently how much it's influenced my personal style. And I think it's not necessarily that I've inadvertently become this sort of Ivan Reitman aficionado, but we have very similar sort of comedic backgrounds in working with sketch comedians and having done live comedy and worked in and around that world, that in combo with Ramis and Bill Murray and Aykroyd, who all came from essentially a sketch background. What Reitman does brilliantly in this film is let everything play, to a large extent, play in master shots, and everything is shot quite loosely and quite wide. And what that enables people like Bill Murray to do is use the whole frame, and it's not and every scene is allowed to play. The scenes aren't cut to within an inch of their lives because you've got, you know, three or four actors together in a scene who are all at the absolute top of their game. They all know each other really well. They have their timing locked down. And there's a lot of improv in the film, particularly from Rick Moranis, obviously, but there's even within the others, there's a huge amount of improv in the film. And so Reitman allows that. He shoots wider. They know he's shooting wider. They know he will use the master shot. They're not worrying so much about continuity and so on. And if you watch the film, there's very rarely a scene which goes into coverage or punches into coverage halfway through a scene. Mm. They only ever do it for comedic effect. There's a scene where Janine is complaining to Bill Murray about not having had a break for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
He says, oh, if you need me, I'll be in my office. And he just walks around the other side of the partition and just sits straight down. and then the camera pulls back and then Spengler pops up from underneath the desk and he's been there for the entire scene. And Janine says, oh, you're very handy, which is, again, a pretty outrageous moment in a family film.
Type something, will you? We're paying for this stuff.
Don't stare at me. You got the bug eyes. Janine, sorry about the bug eyes thing. I'll be in my office.
Very handy, I can tell.
But it's only Reitman only ever cuts like that comedically. Generally speaking, he'll let the scene play in a master shot. I hadn't realised, but it's had a massive influence on me because I hate shooting coverage.
And I think it was Tony Way who said this. He said, when you watch a modern comedy, very often, because it's been improvised and there've been 114 takes, they're cutting. It's a one shot and a one shot and a one shot, and you never get the feeling the people have shared a set.
Yeah,
you don't storyboard,
isn't it?
I don't storyboard. No,
well, actually, I thought that was extraordinary when I came down to the Wrong Man set and just watched you working, and you had there was so much going on, but I didn't realise you hadn't storyboarded a thing.
No, I don't story. I sort of storyboard in my head, I suppose, but I don't do physical storyboards. I certainly don't draw storyboards.
Is that so you can respond to people's movements?
Or? Yeah, 100%. Like I think so many things can happen from finding something with an actor, finding a moment that you hadn't expected, to just the usual practical problems you come across when you turn up at the location and of course it's now raining or it's any number of things. There's sound issues or whatever. So I try and be fleet of foot. I know that in Ghostbusters they had to do a huge amount of storyboarding because of it was in the very early days of visual effects and a lot of them were done optically, and they had to be very, very precise about what was going to be a visual effect and what wasn't.
Mm.
And what they do so well in Ghostbusters, which again has had a huge influence on me, and particularly on the project Truth Seekers that I'm working on at the moment, but in The Wrong Man's and in Stag and almost anything I've done that's got a genre bent, I try and do all of the effects practically and in camera because I want to put, A, because I think it looks better, but also because I want to put the actor in the frame with the effect.
Yeah.
Because I want the actor to be able to react to the effect. And particularly in a comedy, you need to understand what the timing of it is going to be and how to modulate the person's reaction to the thing that they're seeing.
Yeah.
In a big visual effects spectacular where it's not comedic and you're not relying so much upon that timing necessarily, those Marvel movies, for example, I prefer to be there on the day looking at the monitor and I can see, yes, we might have to do some visual effects cleanup or some enhancements later on, but I'm seeing the effect as the viewer will see it. And this film does it amazingly well. Because they couldn't afford it, they held back on the visual effects. And
they're in just the right places.
The visual effects are great because, A, they're optical effects. They're not computer-generated effects.
There's a lot of glass matte paintings. These very 1940s stuff.
And because you can see, because it's always mixed with practical effects, you can see the stop motion effects of
puppets,
of the dog. Yeah, it still feels real because you can see the handmade quality of it.
It's a very classy and classical film because obviously this is a part of that phalanx of films that go, this is modern cinema, blockbuster cinema, the thing that Peter Biskin would argue destroys everything. You go, no, but it's really old-fashioned.
Mm.
It's got stop-motion puppets in it. It's got hand puppets. Mm. It's got even something like the library cards blowing into the air. It's beautiful.
Oh, well, that great sequence.
What a great effect.
The opening sequence of this film is I think should be in the Smithsonian.
If there's something strange in the neighborhood, who you gonna call?
Ghostbusters! I think they got the green light for this. They had 13 months from no screenplay to finishing special effects to make this.
Yeah.
So it's done really fast, but they got Richard Edlund into the special effects, who had been at ILM. He'd done Star Wars, Raiders, and he'd done Poltergeist, and he'd done those for ILM. But ILM were busy making...
Didn't they have to pay to actually set his studio?
Yeah, I think Columbia gave him $5 million, and he said, set up your own Boss Films, or something. His own special effects house.
Mm.
But I think ILM were busy doing probably Temple of Doom, or something, Indiana Jones. They were working for Spielberg anyway.
Mm.
So he had to set up his own thing. But he is a guy who's learned all these tricks, and he's now doing them. I mean, it's an expensive movie, but it's not an expensive movie. It's $30 million or something. It's more expensive than a comedy would normally be. Mm. But they're really spare with them, and they use them really cleverly, and they are classic effects. The other thing I found out, which blew my mind, is that the production designer on this was nearly 70. His name's John DeQuire, I think, or John DeQuire. And he was the production designer on Cleopatra.
Right.
And when you go to the top of that building and all that art deco, this is a 1940s movie. Yeah. It looks like something from classic Hollywood. Yeah. So you've got...
And the score matches it.
Sigourney Weaver sashaying through it in that dress, and you go, this feels like a musical.
Yeah.
It's using its special effects moments like the dance numbers in a musical. It's very old Hollywood. All its values are very old-fashioned, and they just put a little sprinkler of sort of 80s hip on top of it and a bit of a soundtrack.
Yeah, and the practical effects that are in there, the kind of everyday stuff, the library cards is a really good example. But the other one that always sticks in my mind is the... It's literally compressed air.
I was marveling.
It's beautifully done, and you can see the influence on it right through to, if you look at the Harry Potter movies, for example, they try to do these practical effects, but then they've had to do them in CGI, and it's just not quite the same because it doesn't have that tangible quality. You know, in that cold open with the librarian, you don't see anything.
No.
It's all done through the library cards and her reaction. You don't see anything, which is, you know, very clever of them to not show what may not have been a particularly great visual effect right before the film's got going. But also,
I remembered seeing the ghost. I'm mistaken. My brain had put those scenes together. The other thing you do with the practical effects, you cut away from it really fucking quickly.
Yeah.
So you get the editing is always faster. So when there's a stop motion dog or a CGI spectre,
you get off it.
You don't hang on it, which means your brain then fills that in for the next couple of frames.
It's great. And like, you know, I say I shoot with a lot of practical effects, and you're there on set going, oh my God, this looks so bad. Why did I ever think this is somebody wearing a suit? You know, so we have these characters in the show that I've been making. Well, I wanted to do them practically. You know, it would have been tempting to do them as VFX, but I was like, I want the thing there. And so, you know, we've got people wearing suits, and our costume designer, Wiz Francis, made these suits, and we had lots of influences and lots of references, and the drawings look fantastic, and the suits themselves when we got them made looked amazing, and they have these sort of plague masks that they wear that are just sort of terrifying. But then of course you put it on a person, and even a 6-foot movement specialist who knows how to do that kind of thing, when you're standing in a field in, you know, in Buckinghamshire, it's like, oh no, this is appalling. And so you end up, but then your confidence comes back because you think, well, I don't have to show it, and as you've just said, Joel, you can cut away from it, and the blink of it is what gives you the scare. But the practical effects in Ghostbusters, my favourite one is the eggs that fry on the counter.
That's
which
amazing.
Is done
oh, isn't that
in
great?
It's done in camera. There's no cut.
Yeah,
I mean, watching it now on an HD restoration, you can see the edge of the heat pad, but only just. And you certainly wouldn't have been able to see that at the time projected, and
it's amazingly done. She's in camera, she's in shot with it. Importantly as well, and I found this out today, next to that box of eggs is the Stay Puft marshmallow bag.
Yes,
brought back.
Yes.
And do you know why that's there? I never realised. Stay Puft's not real.
Right.
They made it up.
Yeah. That was news to me as well.
It is not an American brand.
So
I have grown up my whole of my life.
Their own movie, yeah.
There are a couple of billboard ads, there's one painted brick ad for it. They've done it. I thought Stay Puft was an American brand like Twinkies that I'd not heard of, but they put the marshmallows there to do it.
To establish it.
To know that at the end, you know that guy.
Yeah.
It's the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
They designed that guy to be the best mascot. There could be a bit of a Michelin Man, Pillsbury Doughboy thing. Mm. I never knew. I thought Stay Puft was a thing. I
tried to think of the most harmless thing. Something I loved from my childhood. Something that could never, ever possibly destroy us. Mr. Stay Puft.
Nice thinking, Ray.
Now, listen, I don't want to try and outrun you here, but
come on.
Having never seen the film before, I also thought Stay Puft was real. I definitely heard of Stay Puft and thought it was real.
Well, you'll have heard of it because of the film.
But it turned into a real thing in my head. And then it was only when I watched the Netflix The Movies We Made documentary about Ghostbusters that I found out that it wasn't real.
It's a British thing. Weirdly, as a British person, I think it enhances it because I went, oh, it's one of those things like when they refer to Tylenol or cilantro that I just have to go, Stay Puft. Yeah, we always did them at S'mores. You were so used to taking on board American bullshit and pretending in the playground that you'd heard of it, that this went in with the same thing.
We used to roast Stay Puft marshmallows by the fire at Camp Wakanda.
Ray has gone bye-bye, Egon. What have you got left?
Sorry, Beckman. I'm terrified beyond the capacity for rational thought.
Stay Puft, when it comes in and they've got that moment where the big guy's going to come in, A is one of the best jokes ever, and you've forgotten that that's a great joke.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, we're talking about this being a children's film. I looked at it and went, oh, shit, it's the goodies. It's the big kitten, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
It literally is three guys who deal with adventure, with a fourth guy added in. Mm. The three guys who deal with adventure and they get attacked by a great, big, funny, cuddly thing and went, no wonder I love this as a kid. This is basically a British TV comedy show. It's got a Monty Python.
Yeah, it's very Python-esque. Very Python-esque indeed. Just the sort of surreality of that, image of that walking down the street.
It's so beautiful. Amazing. Yeah. And that, again, as a special effect, that's not dated at all. That is brilliant.
Well, that's model making. I mean, that's just A1 model making, basically. Just
the city's
absolutely
trumping on, which
stunning.
Is a Godzilla gag.
Yeah.
But it doesn't look like a cheap Godzilla gag. It's an ILM grade one of those.
We've been going about this all wrong. This Mr. Stay Puft is okay. He's a sailor. He's in New York. We get this guy laid, we won't have any trouble.
Yeah, and it's the perfect mix of the practical effects with the foam afterwards. Oh. You know, it's just that perfect. And like they do with Slimer, actually. I have to say, like Slimer, for all of the slight hokiness of the optical effect of Slimer, what they do so well is combining it with practical effects. So, for example, the room service trolleys that go flying along and smash into walls, and then it leaves a trail of real physical slime wherever it goes. It's just done brilliantly. You don't see Slimer go through Bill Murray. You think you do.
Yeah.
You don't see it. They cut away from it.
He's an ugly little spud, isn't he?
I think he can hear you, Ray.
Don't move. It won't hurt you.
Yeah, Aqua is running around the corner and we're in a Steadicam shot with him. We run around the corner and we find Bill Murray covered in slime and says,
he slimed me.
Now, in my head, I was like, oh, yeah, there's a shot where it passes through him. Nope, doesn't exist.
Well, we've always said this, that the funniest jokes and the best scares as well, I suppose, same rules, scary and funny, are made in your head. So the audience get to watch, as you said, generous three shots, four shots of people doing their stuff. And when it does cut, your brain fills in those gaps and it puts in scary stuff and funny stuff.
Yeah.
This film is delightful, which is odd because it could have been a cynical kind of hipster. These guys are the coolest SNL guys, but it's big and goofy and lovable.
Yeah, and when it doesn't work, which is rarely, and far be it from me to judge, but when it doesn't work, it's only because of their love of what they're trying to do. The one that sticks in my head is Rick Moranis at his house party. There's that long, extended, improvised, very Woody Allen-esque take they do where he's saying, these aren't my friends, the clients, dispensing financial information and collecting up the coats. Then he throws the coats into the bedroom and they land on the dog.
Yeah.
And they just hold on the dog way too long. Way too long. They're on it for about 5 seconds. You're like, no, you don't actually need to even see the dog there. They could have had him throw the coats and you hear it. But they've made this very, very expensive animatronic dog.
Yeah.
And they're pretty pleased with it. And they're going to let it sit because they paid for it. And now you would be off that in a heartbeat or not see it at all.
Laugh more, actually. That is a joke that kind of dies. You're throwing the coat on the dog is a terrific, on the script, on the page, a brilliant gag. And I remember this being a lot lighter joke-wise than it was. Watching it again.
It's very joke-heavy. And it's full of visual jokes. And it's full of a lot of what I love, which is when they manage to do both. So they have a joke married to action. There's a great sequence after the end of that Moranis thing where he says, okay, who brought the dog? Which is a great line. But he's being chased by the dog across the streets of New York and he's still talking about the fact that he's going to talk to the residents committee about no pets in the building.
I'm going to bring this up at the next tenants meeting. There's not supposed to be any pets in the building.
Set up this thing as being, this is the jeopardy of the film and we should all be scared of this thing. And Rick Moranis, if anyone's going to be scared, it's going to be this Tully character. And he's still just concerned with it being a sort of oversized pet.
The central core of this, probably Aykroyd's original script, is there's a lot at stake. Hell is going to open. This is Judgment Day. Biblical references. But by putting these characters in there, all of whom are either undercutting it by being too nerdy to see a bigger picture, or in the Bill Murray way of kind of going, well, I've got other priorities. I want to get into this girl's pants. All of that is helping you deal with the fact that this is a horror film.
And the threats that they do all take seriously and don't undercut are the human threats in the film. You know, the humans are the monsters. But, you know, it is the dean and it is
the EPA guy.
They are genuinely worried about him and worried what that's going to do to their business. And that's like a real, you know, a real world threat. And it's interesting. I was reading a thing where Aykroyd was talking about how he wanted to start it with these guys. It worked in a university who were trying to start a business because he was like, it was the 80s. Everyone was trying to start a business.
That was the mode
everyone was in. Very 80s, but quite an adult theme to have very early on in the film, this idea that we're going to go into business and we're going to be enterprising. And then these other people are going to come along, these sort of essential sort of trad conservatives types are going to come along and tell us, no, you naughty kids can't do it this way. You can't play with the big boys, you know. You can't sit at the big boys' table. And that's the threat that's played straight and serious in the film. But that's what makes you care about them. The paranormal stuff is never going to make you care about them.
But they park that quite nicely in the background. The other threat they do, and they deal with brilliantly, I wanted to talk about as an example of brilliant script writing and how to write a good comedy threat script, is they deal with the science is really threatening.
You know, it's just occurred to me, we really haven't had a completely successful test of this equipment.
I blame myself.
So do I.
Don't cross the streams. We've got an unlicensed nuclear accelerator on our back. I remember being quite scared as a kid. And part of that was that amazing sound design where they turn it on in the lift and it goes boom.
Yeah.
Why worry? Each of us is wearing an unlicensed nuclear accelerator on his back.
Yep. Let's get ready. Switch me on.
It's a horrible, frightening noise. Yes, and they back away.
Well, Ramis steps away from it.
Yes, like... And it's a brilliant way of saying the real threat here, the ghosts are dangerous, but these guys not knowing how to work this machinery. And that's a thing that everyone understands. Where your parents have said, step back, I'm lighting a barbecue, to keep away from the oven. There's a real sense that the science will kill them. And I didn't realise that the end scene where they cross the streams to deal with Gozer, they had no ending. And they couldn't work out, because the problem with this, you must know this from writing action movies and Supernatural, anything with that, there's no way of turning off the threat. Turning on the threat's fun in a script. Yeah. Turning it off, the sky is boiling with aliens.
Yeah.
How do you send them all back? The thing that always is a problem in Marvel films and Doctor Who and things. Yep. How do you turn them off? And they came up with, well, we'll cross the stream. Our own science will do it. It'll invert reality. And then they had to go back and insert the don't cross the streams catch line early on, because they had no finale.
The door swings both ways. We could reverse the particle flow through the gate.
How?
We'll cross the streams.
Excuse me, Egon. You said crossing the streams was bad.
Cross the streams.
And I think that's a lovely example of clever script writing, which is, it doesn't matter how you finish it, because by that point, the audience, if the characters are all built up and the jeopardy's clear and you save the guys...
Yes, you just don't want them to die, essentially. Yeah. So,
any excuse, a bit of scientific bullshit. If I know, they said that earlier on. That's the secret bit of... It's like a MacGuffin. It's the other secret thing is, how do you finish this? Well, say at the beginning, don't push that button.
Yeah.
And at the end, it push that button.
Yeah.
Switch off the threat. It's done in a way in this film that, again, it's delightful. It doesn't feel mechanical. It doesn't feel like they've cheated you. I felt the threat when they turned the things on. Boo! At the end, when they crossed the streams, I was really scared.
You're going to endanger us. You're going to endanger our client, the nice lady who paid us in advance before she became a dog.
Not necessarily. There's definitely a very slim chance we'll survive.
But it's also their, you know, obviously it's their lives, and it's New York City, and it's humanity is threatened, but it's also their reputations. It's about their the whole film is about them being petrified about their reputations.
Because the dean says you're a loser.
And the EPA guy says, where did you actually get your scientific qualifications and everything. Everyone is constantly...
Murray's got too many doctorates for a man who behaves like that. I love the fact they're clear. This is before the internet, but he's got them from somewhere.
And there's a really great moment where earlier on in the film, he says, I'm a scientist. And Dana says to him, well, you don't look like a scientist. You act like a chat show host, which is sort of so damning. And then later on, when the violinist or the cellist guy, the sort of love rival...
With the nasal spray.
Yes. He says to her later on when they've had an encounter with Murray, or who was that guy? And she says, he's a scientist. I almost cheered, watching it on my own, because I was like, oh, she's now invested in this guy who doesn't even believe in himself. And I think the whole film, the whole moment on the roof where it's like, think of what's the last thing you can think of? What's the least threatening thing you can think of? This is them at that point being concerned about what people think about them, what the authority figures and what the cool kids think about these, the geeks, the science club.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we're the science club and we've said that we're brilliant and we have been brilliant for a bit, but now we're, it's 0 hour and actually, are we going to be laughed at? And are we going to have to, you know, wet our pants and be walked down, you know, the main corridor of the school with everyone laughing at us?
Yeah.
Again,
yeah,
it's a basic
that's what
thing
they're worried about.
Children understand and a whole audience will understand. When you're looking at these films, especially these films that have been massively popular and have lived for ages, you've got to ask, what are they telling the audience? And the slightly geeky, probably outsidery audience of the science club, the AV club, are being told, don't worry, New York's going to carry you shoulder high. We were the nerds. We were thrown out of our university. No one took us seriously. And at the end of it, we all got together and when our backs were to the wall, I suppose at the end of it, Bill Murray believes in himself.
Yeah.
And if you're what's odd watching these movies where they're all goofy and they've got special effects in, you go, well, what's the core story? Mm. Where do they start and where do they end? And the only person you can really follow in this is Bill Murray, because the other guys just stay the same.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's at the beginning, everyone thinks they're idiots. And at the end of it,
they get a chance.
I love this town.
Well, there's that nice line near the front, isn't there? I've worked in the private sector. They expect results.
Yes. Yeah.
What happens here is that they get tested and they end up with good results.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
God, it's a perfect Reagan story, isn't it? They've actually been televised showing their product.
It's very much a product of the time, I think.
Yeah.
In that regard, but it's also it is also timeless. You know, like a lot of movies of that era. Which I would sort of categorise in a similar bracket, have held up for a similar reason. If you look at Breakfast Club and you look at Ferris Bueller and so on, you know, these are very, you know, stylistically quite similar movies in that they're addressing very similar, sorry, not stylistically, thematically very similar movies in that they're addressing that same thing, which is, you know, what it is to be essentially the underdog kid. And what it is to have a chance to, you know, Weird Science is another one. What it is to have a chance to not be laughed at for a change. And it's what Superbad did. It's what Apatow has done brilliantly. Yeah.
Revenge of the Nerds cinema.
Yeah. And that's essentially what Ghostbusters is for all of its bells and whistles, which it also happens to do really well. You know, it's grown up filmmaking, but it's also just got this very simple, you know, story at its core.
What a perfect place to finish this. Jim Field-Smith, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We came, we saw, we kicked its ass.